This week on F8, The Photographer's Perspective, I talk with Landscape Photographer of the Year, Alex Noriega, about photographing nature and capturing a sense of mystery. I've been fortunate to work alongside some of the world's most inspiring photographers. I've watched how they've helped others at our conferences and transformed the way they see through the lens. Welcome, I'm your host, Chris Smith, founder of Out of Chicago. This is F8, The Photographer's Perspective, the show where we have candid conversations and go in-depth with the pros to get to know them better. Join us each week as we discuss photography, get to know their personal perspectives, and introduce you to new places and experiences, helping you get the most out of your creative passion. All right, I am here with Alex Noriega. Welcome to The Photographer's Perspective. Thanks for coming on the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Now, Alex is the, tell me if I get any of this wrong, 2016 USA Landscape Photographer of the Year and 2016 International Landscape Photographer of the Year. Am I getting all that right?
Yes.
It's crazy. It's like a couple of contests. You ended up winning them both. I mean, I think before that you were doing great work, but it was kind of those things that, at least in my mind, gave you this recognition. Now everyone kind of knows who you are, and I'm sure for you that's been a big change in everything you do too, yes?
Not in how I shoot, but definitely in the business side of things, I think it was beneficial. Those two and the Epson Pano Awards that same year, that was crazy. Just, but I think it gave, I don't know, it lent me credibility, which doesn't really make a whole ton of sense to me, because I don't think that winning a contest necessarily means that your photos are good or means that you're a good photographer. And there are so many amazing photographers that I see enter like International Landscape Photographer of the Year that don't win. I mean, with only one winner a year, just so many people fly under the radar. So I don't think it really means, like, it didn't go to my head or anything. It doesn't mean that I'm amazing, but it was really nice for business. I'll tell you that.
Right. I'm sure. Like, is it with the social media and everything else and building an email list for yourself and all that, it must have made a big difference.
Yeah.
But let's talk more about your photography. Actually, let's talk about it a little bit related to like the International Landscape Photographer of the Year contest, because for that one, you actually have to pick out four different images that you submit. Did I read all this right? Does that make sense?
No, I think I submitted like 10, and they pick. They pick. You rate each image individually. I know because I judged it the following year. They have the winner go on the following year as a judge, and so you just rate each image individually. You don't know who it's from. You don't see them as a portfolio, and then after they kind of collect all the highest rated images and see like, okay, this person had this many, this person had this many, and they just take the four top rated ones, I think, to make that portfolio.
Okay, so they're only showing the top four, like when you go to see yours, but where people rank is actually based on all 10. Is that what you're thinking?
Well, I think it's based on the top four or five. They might have increased it to five since I won. Okay. I remember at the end of the judging process, I initially judged something like 3,000, 4,000 images individually.
Jeez, that's gotta be crazy. That could be a whole podcast in itself right there talking about that.
Yeah, they paid for it though. I mean, so that's nice. They then presented us with portfolios like at the very end, like the top six or 10, four or five image portfolios, and then we were rating them again just based on those collections. So
really my question is, like, how do you go through your entire portfolio and narrow it down to the ones, those 10 that you want to submit? Because that in itself is a huge job and takes a real eye just to choose your own images. Have you got tips for people that are doing that, even if it's for their local contests or whatever?
Sure. Well, I think curation is something that I naturally am big on anyway. I don't release all that many images, maybe like 40 or 50 a year now, which I consider a high output. It used to be even lower. And I think that I just go through a natural curation process every time I'm even coming out with a collection of new images. And then I also curate my own favorites gallery on my website all the time. So I just kind of picked from there. Like, is this one good enough to compete? And if so, it made the cut. And if not, I'm like, well, I don't want to spend an extra $25 or however much it is per image on that one. I don't think it's going to get me anywhere. So it was a combination of choosing my favorites and choosing ones that I thought might be a little more popular, but that does overlap with a lot of my favorites. So as far as advice goes, I'd say don't present too many versions of the same thing. Like if you want, if you sat there all afternoon and shot the same scene with changing light, maybe just choose the best frame and make that the definitive version of that scene. You don't need to show five copies of it because then you're just diluting all of it.
All right, that all makes sense. You talk somewhere, I read this online, you talk about one of the things you're looking for in your images is a sense of mystery. Can you go into depth on that a little bit?
Yeah, well, that's a pretty big topic, I think. But for me, what that means is that I want to spark my imagination. I want to, even when I'm viewing my own images, I want to imagine what could be beyond the frame or where what I could be looking at. And so, for example, I just think of this image of mine in Death Valley. It's just kind of tight on some layers of mountain geology there and some dappled light, but it looks like kind of foreboding and almost volcanic to me. And like, if I didn't know exactly where I took it, I feel like I'd imagine that was Mordor or something, you know, like, and it's
right.
Easier for me personally to get the imagination rolling when there's not an entire wide scene with a sky that shows how everything is. But if you just take a sliver of the landscape, a small section of it, then it kind of spurs the imagination to be like, what else is there? What am I actually looking at? And you think about the image, and that gives it a sense of mystery for me when I don't know everything about it.
And makes people take more time to look at it and to figure out kind of what's going on and where was this shot, as opposed to that grand landscape, which is just, okay, I see exactly where that is.
Yeah. And especially with the, you know, with a wide angle, you can almost imagine standing there in that exact spot because you're seeing such a wide angle of view, and even like the stretching of the wide angle on the edges of the image, like it all just kind of makes you think I'm standing here in the same spot the photographer was standing with a super wide angle lens. I see everything here. It could be amazing. It could make you want to go there. You could be like, this is a place I want to see, but it doesn't really have a lot of mystery in my eye.
Yeah. And if you're standing at the edge of a cliff and you shoot that wide angle, there's not a whole lot of options, but when you pull out a real long lens, there's maybe hundreds of photos that you could make.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Which makes it so that you've got a better chance of making something that's different than what everyone else has got, which is really, I mean, I think what makes your work special is how many, you know, there's not many images where you go, well, that kind of reminds me of this guy's and that reminds me of her shot. But yours really, you know, stand out as being different than anything else that's out there.
Well, I appreciate that. That's a great compliment, I think. To try to be original at all in this age is difficult because, I mean, we're all standing on each other's shoulders and on the shoulders of giants. And I'm certainly influenced by a lot of people and a lot of great photographers. And I go to a lot of the same places, but if you can just find some way to make it your own, I think that's really satisfying.
Yeah. Are you the type to follow a lot of other photographers and get ideas? Or are you more the, I've heard people say like, you know, like a social media celibacy or something, you know, where it's like, I'm not going to look at anybody else's pictures because I want to just get what's in my mind.
I don't really practice the celibacy. No, I follow a lot of people. The thing is, I do get ideas all over, subconsciously and consciously, but I don't, just because I see someone's photo from a place, it's not going to make me see that as the only way that could be shot. Like, I still feel like I have very strong personal preferences on visual relationships and composition and even the choice of subject. So I don't feel like that affects me that much, but it does probably on some subconscious level. And I think that some of my strong work has at least been partially influenced by a number of different people. So maybe you don't see it and it reminds you of one person, but if I pointed out one person's work that I was thinking of in this one aspect of that image, you might recognize that.
Do you think that for newer photographers, it's a good technique to say, hey, I want to go out there and make an Alex Noriega type shot, or I want to make one that's like Art Wolf or whatever. Is that a good idea? Or is it better to just be like, from the very beginning, I'm doing my own thing?
That's kind of a tough question because there are two schools of thought on it. One is that, yeah, it is a good learning technique to kind of mimic or at least dissect what you like about other photographers' work and try to replicate that and figure out how do I do that in my photo here? I don't think that's a bad thing. But at the same time, I do think you, especially early on, kind of box yourself into those ideas if you focus on them too much. And you might miss something that you would have come up with on your own if you were not saddled with any preconceptions. So there's no blanket advice I can give, but I would say that I definitely was inspired a lot early on, but I was also making a lot of shots that were pretty much copies early on. And it wasn't until I felt like I had done enough of that and just started going out on my own, trying to find my own stuff, that I really became satisfied with my work. And I think that's when it got better too. So,
yeah. Tell us a little bit about your history. Like, what were you doing before you were in photography? How long have you been doing this? Just quickly.
About 10 years, coming up on 10 years now. Before that, I was doing computer science work, or rather that was my major, and then working with computers. Okay, let me back up. I dropped out of college, which sounds bad, but it ended up working out really well because I became self-employed. After holding some computer jobs, I started finding my own clients, running my own business. And so I had all this free time because I set my own schedule, and I bought a camera, started messing around with it, and just became obsessed with just the mechanics of photography and light and depth of field and playing with all the settings. And it just gave me so much freedom to explore and learn photography, being self-employed already. And then it made it easy to transition to making photography my income as people started gaining interest in my work.
And so, did you start, like a lot of people, shooting all different types of things and eventually said, no, it's the landscapes, that's mine? Or how was that for you?
Yeah. I did shoot all sorts of work. I shot a lot of portraits. I did a lot of cityscapes, architecture. I even started, it's kind of funny, if you look at my architectural work from early on, I started with like skylines and big scenes and then kind of moved to architectural abstracts and just kind of finding the shapes within these interesting buildings.
Do you still do that?
Later, where my nature work went. No, I don't shoot anything but nature now.
We got to have you come teach out of Chicago and do shoot here in Chicago. It's great, great architecture and great architectural abstracts. We'll get you back into it.
My buddy Tom Harris lives in Chicago. He's one of the best architectural photographers I'm aware of, and he runs his own firm now. I learned a lot from him early on, but I just have no interest in architecture for myself. This happened over time, but I took a road trip from Minnesota out to California, and I went through the mountains in Colorado and all the deserts in Utah and Nevada and Arizona. And that's really what spurred my love of the landscape, because I grew up in the Midwest and I didn't really see much other than cornfields. I didn't know what mountains and deserts were really like. I'd only seen them in movies and TV and video games. So it was really cool to see all that in person, and that really started my imagination going. And when I moved to Oregon in 2012, that's really when I decided I was doing only landscapes. So they moved me so much more. Nature moves me. And I think it has wider appeal too than most other types of photography.
Yeah, I think that's definitely true from what we've seen, and lots of nature landscape photographers out there as well. But like, what is it? Is it that the images that you get are so much better, or than doing architecture and buildings, or is it that you just really like being out in nature?
Photography kind of fostered my love of being out in nature, which is the opposite of what a lot of landscape photographers will tell you, that they started out hiking and then they brought their camera along and then eventually got into photography.
Right.
I lived in the city. I didn't go out in nature much before starting photography, and it's really just spurred this love for the landscape and getting out there and solitude and light and weather and all this. The natural world is just so incredible. It's so awe-inspiring. And then you compare that to, for example, shooting architecture. And this is not to say anything bad of incredible architectural photography, but for me, it just doesn't move me. It feels like I'm just capturing someone else's art, so to speak. I mean, the the architect and the designers of the building. But at the same time, I mean, the people that do it really well, it's incredible what they do. Like my buddy Tom, it's so...
And they make it their own.
It's so clean. It's such a great representation of the buildings. And really, I mean, not to downplay that at all, but for me, it just, I never felt like I was able to make or to put me into the image when I was shooting buildings. And with nature, I find that there's just a lot more mystery to be found. And I guess maybe that's what it is for me. That nature can be so mysterious. And just when I'm in a city and I see even the coolest building I've ever seen, there's really no mystery there for me. You know, that's a designed object by man, and I'm surrounded by other people, and there's nothing crazy going on. It's all like a very controlled environment, right? But in nature, you can come across just the most insane thing that has taken millions of years to form, and you're the only one that's ever seen it possibly. And it's just a different feeling. And so that comes through in the photos for me too, I think.
Wow. Now, a lot of your shots are these like intimate scenes, and a lot of them are just like, I want to say like so intimate that they're just really zoomed out in on a small part. And it's just like this pattern. You talked earlier about the wide angle scene and, you know, you can see where you are. Are you shooting most of these with a pretty long telephoto lens, or what's the secret? What's the secret, Alex? Come on.
I don't think that telephoto really is necessary to make a mysterious photo. I will use a wide angle up close on subjects. It's more about your perspective and your framing, but it's true that telephotos will help you isolate, because in nature especially, you can't always get close to what you want to photograph. And also you might want that compression from having a far away perspective, like where you can play with the relationship of size between smaller and larger objects. I mean, that's, you get close on something with a wide angle and the thing that's close to you is going to look gigantic. I mean, you can't really do a whole lot with perspective that way. You're kind of stuck with the near far, even when you have a super wide angle, and like a mysterious or tight composition. But yeah, get farther away and you can do a lot with visual relationships with the telephoto lenses. I don't know that that's the secret though. I think it's more about, if you think about it from a viewer's perspective, what gives away what the scene is like, what tells the viewer where you were standing or where this photo was taken or what this place is like, those things you might actually want to exclude them. Like the sky is a big one, but there are all sorts of clues you can give the viewer if you want to give them context. And I actually try to eliminate that to get them thinking. But I'm not really thinking about how a viewer looks at my photo. I'm just, this is how I see it too.
Yeah, that's a different question I have for you. But what you just said kind of makes me think of when I see newer photographers and they say, well, I've got a pretty cool photo, but I added this and I made sure that was in the shot. And then I added this and it made it even, how would that not be even better? But it seems that the more you add, the less impact an image has, and yours goes the whole opposite extreme. And you do that intentionally, right?
Right. But I can't take credit for that. That's a central tenet of photography, I think, that it's an exclusionary art rather than additive.
But it's one that people don't practice as much as they should. So
right, especially with, I mean, the emphasis on wide angles and like all these new lenses, like 12 to 24s, 11 to 24s that keep coming out. It's like there are certain situations that they're incredible. Like say you're in a cave with lots of striated lines all around you, you can make it look insane. But you point that same thing at a big scene and all of a sudden you just have 180 degree field of view. Everything in the scene is tiny. Everything's insignificant except for what's right in front of you. And right. So you end up with like flowers that take up half the scene, and then like, you know, you have a whole mountain range that's just this tiny little background detail.
Right.
And what's the photo about at that point? Is it about the flowers? Is it about the mountains? Like I think that if you make a photo about something, if you select a subject more carefully, rather than trying to add everything in, but maybe choose, okay, this thing is what's most interesting to me, I'm going to focus on that, then you can actually make it more interesting than if you had everything in there and the viewer doesn't even know where to look.
Interesting. But that is a technique too, that people use those ultra wide angle lenses, and it's mostly about that one thing. Like I went to that photo pills camp and was hanging out with Daniel Corden, and that's like his thing. And that's what he was teaching people, you know, get that ultra wide angle lens as close as you possibly can, like you said, to a rock formation or to flowers or whatever it is. And that's its own thing, but that's an interesting point. That's not really your thing, even though that's been kind of popular lately.
Yeah, I think it's been popular, and with good reason, or with a reason. It's visually striking, and Daniel's got great work, but I just don't see it that way, really. When I see a shot like that, I can't help but think of the photographer crouching down there with their wide-angle lens, and maybe the general public doesn't think that way when they see that shot, but at least for me, knowing how cameras and lenses work, I just cannot get past that, like feeling like I am just seeing them sitting there holding their camera an inch away from the flowers, or like trying to get their tripod as low as possible to the ground. And that just kind of breaks the fourth wall, so to speak, for me.
You know too much.
I know too much. Yeah. If you had just come up with some sliver of that scene, then I would have to think about, okay, what is this? And what else might there be there in that scene? And what's the light doing here? Like it gives too many clues when you go that big, I think. So I haven't owned a lens wider than 24 millimeters in 3 years, I think.
Oh, wow. So that's what I was going to ask you. I mean, yeah. The listeners want to know, like, what do you use? What are your favorite lenses? What camera do you use? I'm just going to ask it. So,
okay. So. I'll preface it by saying it really doesn't matter,
yes.
but I have a Canon 5D Mark IV. I used to shoot Nikon, and I just really like how the Canons feel, the live view, the color in the files, the interface, the menus. They just feel really intuitive to me, and I just like using it.
To me, it's a live view that hit, like, I've always used live view, and trying to use some of the Nikons, maybe the newer ones are better, but the Canon live view is really good.
Yeah, it's super responsive. It's super fast. And it works really well in low light because they keep the aperture open unless you hold the depth of field preview. Whereas on the Nikons, it'll stop down to whatever you have it set at. So if you want to use it in low light, you have to open your aperture up, then do your focusing, and then close it back down before you shoot. And I always found that tedious. So the live view, and then the 5D Mark IV actually has great dynamic range too. That's the one knock you hear on Canon. Granted, it's only, and I'm holding up finger quotes right now, only 30 megapixels, but I think that's plenty for huge prints too. So I really like the Canons. And then I have a 24-105, the Canon F4L. And right now I've got a Sigma 100-400 just because it's lighter. I really like the Canon 100-400, but it's a whole pound heavier, and hiking, it's kind of annoying. So just those two lenses, the 24-105 and a 100-400, you could make 95% of the work on my site with those. Wow. And then I've got a little extension tube so I can get closer with the 100-400 for like ice macros or smaller stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. As opposed to having to carry a full macro lens with you all the time.
Yeah, because I don't use it that often.
Wow.
And then a polarizer for each lens and tripod. That's pretty much it. I mean, it's a really simple kit.
And away you go. Yeah, that 24-105. That when I shot Canon, that was my favorite. And then when Sony came out with 24-105, I got that. So we'll see. But yes, I agree. I love that range, and it just covers so much for you.
Yeah.
Let's talk about places. Like you're living in the Portland area, but am I right about that? Yeah.
Yeah. Right now, yeah.
But your favorite place to shoot is the Southwest. Tell us like your favorite places. Tell us like places that, like, if you had to just stay in one spot the whole time and just travel a short distance, yet, you know, that would be everything you'd ever need. What's the spot?
It's a tough call. I've talked to my friends about this. If we could only have one national park for the rest of your life.
Right.
Zion would be a pretty good choice if it was not so crowded. I really can't stand how many people there are, and you can't even drive your own vehicle in there. You have to take the shuttles. But Zion's amazing. The landscape is incredible. But the reality of it is that you're dealing with a lot of other people a lot of the time. So I would probably go with Death Valley. I love the diversity. It's so huge. I'm not sure. Is it the biggest national park by area? I think it might be. But the diversity is just so crazy. And when you first drive through Death Valley, it just looks, especially if you do it midday, it just looks like a huge brown, barren wasteland. But because it's the confluence of three different deserts, and you have all these mountains and just all this incredible geology, if you look closer, there's just so much there. So many different things that happen with floods and light and sand and mud and the Badlands. And just if you look really close and explore Death Valley beyond the big spots, you could spend a lifetime there. So that would definitely be a contender for me. Possibly Capitol Reef in Utah, that whole area. It's the least visited of their five national parks, and that's one of the pluses for me. I really don't like dealing with throngs of other photographers or tourists.
How do you deal with that when you get to a place? I'm just going to fight it, or you say, hey, I'm going somewhere else where no one else is, or
what? Well, I'll just go somewhere else. Yeah. I mean, even in Zion, for example, you just take a hike on a less popular trail or to a more remote place, or, you know, you go beyond the first 2 miles of a hike and all of a sudden there's almost no one there. So just try to get away, hike away, or find a super remote corner of the park that requires four wheeling. That'll keep the people away.
Right. You know, you've got so many shots that, kind of like you said, you don't know exactly where you are. You know, it's these intimate scenes. They're not just about this epic standing on the edge of the cliff thing. Are there certain places that you go to when you're looking for those? Or would you tell people that's the type of thing you could do just in your local area? Or if someone's interested in getting those types of shots, what do you recommend?
Well, depends on your local area. But yeah, you could find a really cool like tree shot in your park if you just exclude the whole ground of the park and just focus on the trees and the canopy. There could be something really interesting up there. That being said, I really think that being away from cities and away from civilization helps with the process, and you tend to find more wild things. So I would recommend at least going to like a state park or a national park. That being said, if it's a place that's known for big scenes like the Grand Canyon, that's kind of a bad example because you're so limited on the edge of the Grand Canyon. You can't really change your perspective much, and everything's so big and so far away that it just usually turns into bigger scenes. Even if you isolate part of the Grand Canyon, you're kind of doing the same thing. But you take something like Zion or Death Valley or Capitol Reef or even Mount Rainier, like just somewhere where you can get into smaller areas, like get into a canyon or get into this little nook or that cranny. Like you can find insane stuff everywhere. You don't have to go to the big shot.
Yeah, I'm kind of here. Every episode I try and ask it just seems to happen, just personal questions. So but from me, like the things I want to know. So what I want to know, let's do an out of event, but let's do it in a place that's not really known as like a bucket list location, a place where there's not going to be very many people, but where we know we're going to be able to find some really interesting small scenes when we go there and be able to make something interesting different than what everyone else does and know that we can be there without a ton of people. What's the place? And I try and put people on the spot. So there you go.
I don't want to sound like a broken record, but I mean, Death Valley is amazing. Zion is really great if you get away from the people. I mean, it's just a very diverse landscape. I should say Olympic is incredible. Up in Washington, the coasts are kind of straightforward, although there's a lot of cool like sand stuff and patterns in the sand, but the forests are just crazy, like how unique they are and how much little stuff you can find there that's totally different. I don't know, man. I think the desert is the way to go though overall, because the desert is so diverse. I think of it as like a sprawling barren landscape, but really it's just so many interesting things happen in deserts, especially with water, like the way that floods happen and canyons and the way that light bounces in those canyons. And you'll get like lone trees that are all gnarled because they're barely hanging on and they're like living in this canyon, as opposed to say an Olympic where you have thousands of trees per square mile. Like, it's just really interesting in the desert. Wherever you see life or wherever water has affected it, it feels more meaningful and more strange too, you know? So I think any sort of desert landscape where you can kind of get into some canyons would be an incredible place to do that.
All right. I like that. I imagine that when you're leading your workshops, those are the things that you can help people with quite a bit as well, as opposed to these big grand epic things. Cause like where are you going to stand? Like the grand epic shots, like, okay, well, I know where to stand, right at the edge of the cliff or whatever it happens to be. But I imagine you can help people on your workshops with those other types of shots quite a bit.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's what I've made the focus of my workshops. I run Death Valley workshops with my buddy TJ Thorne, and that's all we focus on pretty much. We don't want to take people to bucket list items and just show them, here's where you stand, point at that, there's your shot. We want them to find their own shots, but we want to put them in a place where there are shots to be found and there's a lot of little interesting details to pick up. And I think just showing people examples of things that I'm finding, like new things, is really helpful for them, as opposed to in the past I had people that wanted to go basically to the bucket list, the checklist of big shots, and you take them there, you show it to them, and then
I really didn't
feel like I was doing much at that point. I mean, I can tell you, like, okay, maybe you should exclude this rock from the right side of your frame, but I mean, there's not a whole lot to say at that point because it's quote unquote the shot. You're already there. It's pretty obvious. I want people to find their own shots. So I show them how I find shots, and then they start getting their own ideas, like, oh, okay, I should just look at, you know, the details and find what interests me, or what's the light doing? Like, maybe I should focus on that rather than just trying to have that be a detail in a big scene.
F8, the photographer's perspective, is brought to you by Out of Chicago. Out of Chicago brings together passionate enthusiasts with world-class photographers all in one epic location where you learn and shoot side-by-side with the pros. Since 2014, we've organized hands-on photography conferences in Chicago, New York City, Moab, and more. We are all photographers ourselves, so we understand what it takes to be inspired, get to the right place at the right time, and live our best creative life. I went on your website and looked on your page with your post-processing videos, and just to take the sliders for the different videos from left to right, from the before to the afters on those images, you know, actually the thing that went through my head when I did that was, wow, I have pictures just like the ones on the left. You mean I could turn them into the ones on the right? Tell us a little bit about your post-processing that you do.
Well, that's part of the point of those before and after sliders, is to show you that, like, this... some of these scenes do not look that way straight out of camera, especially not if you're exposing to the right. All your files should be like really bright and kind of washed out to start out. But what I'm doing is I'm not afraid to completely change an image. I'm just trying to keep the base content real. Like, I'm not dropping in skies or creating total composites or anything, but I'm also not afraid to take what nature gave me, which may be just this little tiny bit of light that wasn't all that contrasty, and just really push that to emphasize it. But the end result, I always want to be realistic or believable, because kind of like with wide angles, what I was saying earlier, I think that taking it too far in post-processing is just breaking the fourth wall. You ruin the experience for someone when they know that it was just a slider in Photoshop.
or a preset button.
Preset. Like, that's why, I mean, I don't do anything with presets. People ask me if I have presets. Like, no, there's no preset for, it's on a per image basis. You have to actually decide what you want to do with it, or at least play with it and see what it gives you.
What software are you typically using to edit your stuff?
Just Camera Raw and Photoshop, or Lightroom. You could use Lightroom. I don't like Lightroom. It's slow. I like Camera Raw, but they work exactly the same way.
Yeah. Especially because you're like a one image guy, you know? Like, if you're shooting a wedding and you got to have, you know, 500 images.
Right.
You know,
Lightroom's great for organization. I just don't want to actually be editing with it because I just think everything's slower and more complicated than it needs to be. I guess I'm a little old school in that way.
No, that's good. That's not a bad thing.
Yeah, so, and I'm pretty good at organizing my files. So the bridge just shows you your actual file structure in Lightroom, I think, is if you have a lot more exposures. I don't take that many exposures. I might come back from a shoot with, you know, 100 different exposures, and I'll pick three of them or something. So it's not
That was something I was going to ask you, like, for some of these like small scenes, these intimate scenes, I'm sure that you got to work the scene to get the exact shot that you want, but how many actual exposures are you taking? Like some of your shots that have won these awards, like how many shots did you take to get to that one? Or is it typically, hey, this is it and it's one?
I'll sit there and shoot it before the light's perfect and after the light's perfect. And I already know, like, okay, the moment's probably already passed, but I'm just going to keep shooting this because it's really nice. But yeah, I might only pick one of those shots, and that might only be a series of 20 shots or something. It depends on how much the light is changing and if I'm shooting anything dynamic, like moving water. Clearly, if you shoot a lot of different water exposures, that'll jack up the number quite a bit. I've definitely come back with coastal shoots with several hundred. But yeah, like for example, there was this Dune shot, Ballad of Gales, that won.
Yep.
Was part of the portfolio for the international. I think I have 4 RAWs of that. And it was windy and it was handheld because I couldn't even take the time to get the tripod set up before that light was gone. I think the sun was right about to dip below the horizon. So I just shot off 4 exposures and I used one of them. So. And I mean, a lot of the shots are like that. Yeah.
That's one of them you go through in those videos, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So just tell me, like, what are the main things that you're doing to give yourself contrast to? Are you using luminosity masks? Like, give me the basic rundown. Come on, you can share it. Then we'll buy the video.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Well, you'll learn a lot more than this in the videos, but for contrast, I'm always working, both with shadows and highlights independently, not the shadow and highlight sliders, but the way that contrast works, if you just drag your contrast sliders, it's going to make your darks darker and your brights brighter, right? But it does them both equally at the same time. And it also adds quite a bit of color in the process. So what I like to do to have more control is I use the exposure slider and the black slider and sometimes the shadows to control the low end of the contrast to kind of move around where the lower midtones and shadows are in the image. And then I'll use like the white slider separately to pump up the highlights, and I don't even touch contrast. So I'm kind of moving the shadows to be darker, but not super contrasty because I don't like super black shadows. And then kind of pushing my highlights so that the highlights do the talking, and the highlights are where the color comes in. And I'll use the white slider for that.
That's a really interesting point. I just want to, the one thing that you don't like dark shadows, because when I was in Spain, Daniel Corden was doing a post-processing session. He said the same thing. I process it, I get my blacks exactly right, and then I take that black level up like 6 notches or whatever it happens to be. He goes, I never want just black. And I always saw it from like the Ansel Adams perspective or whatever. You always had to have like that zone system. There's got to be part of it that's completely black. Is that just a black and white thing or just your
preference? I think it works better in black and white to be super contrasty. I also think it depends on the scene entirely, because you may have a scene that you want to go high key, or you might want to have a softer feel on it. For example, like a foggy image, you don't want blacks because fog is going to soften up all your shadows in reality too. So if you want to convey that foggy feeling, you don't want to make that too contrasty. You actually want lower contrast. And right. So like depending on the feel you want the image to have, if you want an airy, bright, clean, cool feel, you're not going to want deep shadows. But maybe you want it to be more bold and it's like a pattern shot and it's all about the color and the shapes, and then you could go a little farther with the contrast. Or if you're in black and white already inherently has a disconnect from reality, so it's easier to take things farther without it looking strange or overdone. So I think that's what Ansel was doing. He was, you know, experimenting with what at the time was probably the craziest photo manipulation. And that works really well for those types of dramatic black and white images. But for me, I just feel like it always makes it look overdone on a color image almost all the time. So
interesting.
I prefer to keep the shadows softer. And that makes sense with Daniel's work. He's got a really airy feel to his processing.
Yeah. So you were saying all the sliders that you're moving, this is so far all just global adjustments, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
So I do use luminosity masks in Photoshop. I'm using Tony Kuiper's panel now. But that's not, they're just a tool. They're not contributing anything to the look of the image. Like people are like, oh, this image looks like it was made with luminosity masks. I'm like, there's nothing there that suggests the luminosity masks were made except that everything's well controlled. They're just a really precise tool, but it's still about what you do with them. So yeah, I'm using them in Photoshop to work really precisely with light. And that's pretty much what I do once I'm in Photoshop, aside from cloning, which is always huge to remove distractions. I'm doing a lot of working with light really precisely because I want to take what nature gave me in terms of light and emphasize it without it looking painted on, without it looking forced globally on the whole image. You really want to focus it on where you want the viewer's attention and where the actual light would be in the scene. So that's what I'm using the luminosity masks in Photoshop for. And masks and layers, you can just get really creative and really, really precise.
And what's your latest video? It's supposed to be coming out. It says end of July, so you better not screw this up.
Yeah, I have 6 days to finish it. It's called The Edge of Light, and it's working on 3 different photos in 3 different kinds of light. So one of them is a dune shot where it was the very last light of the evening, and I really wanted to emphasize that in the processing. So you'll see on the before and after slider that it was kind of this whole dune was illuminated originally. But I wanted it to be like just that very last gasp of light. So I kind of made it, the light's just barely hitting the crest of the dune. And so that one will be all about working creatively with that light to give it that super dramatic end of the day feel. And then there's a pre-dawn twilight shot of some Badland walls. And that one is just working with super soft light to kind of give it this blue silvery feel, which a lot of people have asked me about because a lot of my photos, especially in the past, were this kind of uniform blue. And it's just a really, really nice look as opposed to the brown of the raw. And so that's kind of getting creative because it was not blue at all in person. But
and is that just straight out a white balance thing, or is there a lot more in depth that you do to get that?
Well, you'll have to buy the video. No, but
it is a
very cool white balance. Yeah, but then I don't want the whole thing to look like the white balance slider was dragged down, right? So if you look at the photo, it's got like really silvery highlights, and I do a lot to actually control that blue and make sure that the highlights still stand out and everything doesn't look just painted blue. And then the last one is a photo from Death Valley of some dappled light. I think I mentioned it earlier, on these layers, and really just wanted to make that look dramatic. And that's actually like 2 p.m. light. Like I was sitting there in broad daylight shooting that, but these clouds were casting these shadows across the valley. And so you get all these little spots of light across the landscape. And that's how I, on that one, I think I take 4 different exposures and 4 different moments of light and kind of combine them to get even distribution and then dramatize it.
Yeah, I love that. That's the shot that I was like, hey, I got a shot like that on the left, not like the one on the right. Yeah, I love that. Now, are you doing some painting in also, or is it all just like through selections with luminosity masks?
Well, I'll paint in for sure through a mask, or I'll use a mask on top of what I painted. It's definitely very selective, but the mask is still necessary to make it land like on a per pixel basis where the actual light was. You can paint in, you could spend all day painting manually on these spots of light on that land, and it would not look natural no matter how long you took. I don't think it would still look painted because you're just not going to match every little detail of the landscape. So the luminosity masks kind of naturally pick up. As long as you're working through a luminosity mask with those kind of adjustments, it looks way more realistic.
And if someone wants to learn luminosity masks, you recommend Tony Kuiper's and
Sean Bagshaw.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Those tutorials for Tony Kuiper. My videos are not about learning the luminosity masks themselves because Sean and Tony have done a great job of coming up with a whole course on that. They're just, my videos are about using these things creatively. And I actually probably use the tools way more simply than a lot would, but I can do a lot with them. You don't really need to get too crazy with your tools. It's just about control.
Yeah.
So these give you a lot of control.
Learn 6 or 7 things really well and you can do a whole lot, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. So you're going to be with us at the Out of Yosemite event in February. Have you shot much in Yosemite?
No, I don't have any Yosemite images, actually. I've been to Yosemite, but I don't like what I shot when I was there. It was probably 9 years ago or something. I'm really excited to go, though. The people that you have are amazing.
Yeah. Who are some of the people? I got the whole list here, but who are the some of the people, I'm putting you on the spot here, that you're excited to work with?
I could Charlotte Gibb. I know her. Her work is incredible and obviously very Yosemite focused. Mm-hmm. And you got Michael Fry, who wasn't he a student of Ansel Adams or knew Ansel?
You know, I think he never met him. Fry didn't.
But William Neal did, right? Yep, yep. And, John Sexton.
John Sexton for sure.
And then Charles Kramer did not. He wasn't an Ansel guy, right? But he's amazing.
He is amazing. Yes. Uh-huh. Yeah. And who's like Alan Ross was a guy that he still's the only one that does the special edition prints for the Ansel Adams Gallery. He'll be one of the instructors. So yeah, it's all these guys.
Basically, I'm in incredible company, and I don't know why you picked me, but thank you.
But yeah, I'm super excited about that one. And a lot of these people are amazing at black and white, but also to look for those small scenes and to find ways to make shots that are different than everyone else. So I'm just excited to get all these people together and, you know, bounce ideas off each other and give people, just great ideas to go out and shoot for themselves too.
Oh, I think that'll be great. And I think I should mention, you're kind of saying that this is my thing, like finding the unique scenes.
Oh,
it's
not, yeah.
It's an old school thing. It's actually, these people have been doing this. Like if you look at William Neal's book, his retrospective book, I've got it on my shelf here. It's incredible. He's got these photos that I'll open it up. I'm like, man, that is amazing. I am jealous of that shot. I wish I had seen that. And it's like 1983. It's like this guy was doing this 35 years ago. And yeah. I mean, I cannot take any credit for that approach to photography. I'm just looking at the masters and trying to pick up a little bit here and there on how they did it.
You just happen to be really good at it. How's that?
Maybe. Time will tell.
So, No, I said the same thing when I was looking through William Neal's stuff. And I was like, wow, this is kind of just like Alex Noriega's and Sarah Marino's. And like you said, it's like, but he was doing this in the 80s or whatever. It's like, wow, right, that's really impressive.
Yeah, it's not my idea. It's just I pull inspiration from everyone whose work I enjoy. And I try to put a little bit of whatever I like into my work. And so if that comes across as William Neal, I'm happy.
No, so that's going to be a really fun event. You're going to come with us to Acadia as well in the fall, right?
Yep.
That's great. Are you guys, you're doing a trip out there yourself already? Is that the idea?
Yeah, my girlfriend and I will be living in the trailer full time. So we had an East Coast trip planned already. And now that I agreed to do Acadia, it's...
you can't say no now. I'm sorry.
Yeah, that's all right. We've got some plans for Europe after that, where we're going to be flying out of the East Coast. So it'll all work out.
Oh, wow. That's awesome. So yeah. So we're excited to have you in Acadia as well. And Sarah Marino will be with us for that one. And Colleen Minnick and Aaron Pubnick, some really good
photographers. I know all of them. Yeah, they're all great.
Yeah. So that'll be really special as well. We haven't talked at all about this, so this is totally putting you on the spot. But like... What types of things do you think you're going to want to be teaching for a presentation, or what do you think are the main things you can help people with? Some of the same things we've talked about today, I'm sure, right?
Yeah. I think I can definitely help with processing since we were just on that subject. I would consider that to be one of my strengths. I have the background in computers, so all the technical aspects of it came easy to me. And I want to show people how to be creative with it, and how to use these simple tools to do really incredible, like precise things, because it's all about the photos being believable in the end for me.
Yeah. To me, what's special about doing an event like this is that, not just the different perspectives from different photographers, but the fact that they'll get a chance to sit down and watch you process some of your images. But then there will be time later in the week where they'll be working on their own and get some immediate feedback from you. And you can say the things like, hey, you know what? You did that black slider like I was talking about in the podcast. You did it just too far. And it's a little bit unrealistic now, because that's the type of thing with a new eye. It's hard to know when you've gone too far, unless you've got, you know, a mentor kind of next to you help.
And it's all relative. Like you can, on my own image, I mean, I'll take it too far. And then the next day I'll look at it and realize that's crazy. I need to pull that back.
Right.
So it's all relative, even time-wise. Like you just need fresh eyes, even your own fresh eyes. You just need to give things time and you'll actually start to see more clearly, because, or more objectively, I should say, because you're not emotionally attached to the initial thing that you did. So that's another thing I think I can help with. I really like working with curation and critique and helping improve images. So if people, you know, have a set of images that they took around the conference, I can help them pick out their best ones and kind of make suggestions on how to improve those with cropping or processing or whatever. And then I guess the last thing would be about being in the field, and it's not the last thing, but
in the field,
I want to show how I see, how I find these small things and observe the light and just kind of let the images come to me. That's kind of how I've approached it for a couple of years now. I'm not out in search of a specific image. I'm trying to see what nature gives me, and it may be really small. It may be something that most people would walk right by, but you can show how incredible it is with the right composition and light.
Right. And that's one of the things I wanted to ask, like this image that you've got that was also one of those in the portfolio, Sanctuary. It's this small white flower surrounded by ferns. Looks like it's, I don't know how to explain it, but an amazing shot. Like for something like that, are you like, okay, I'm going to go find a little flower and some ferns? Or are you just like, I'm just going to see what's out there?
Well, I got to give credit to my friend Alex Modi, who's not really shooting much anymore as far as I know, but he had an incredible shot called Eternal Mystery, I think. You could Google Alex Modi, Eternal Mystery. And that was, you know, some ferns and white flowers. I think it was from Olympic somewhere. And that had that idea planted in my head of like, I should be looking at the ground because there's awesome stuff down there. And these ferns are really cool, like all the kind of concentric repeating patterns in them. And sometimes you'll find these little oxalis flowers popping up and they're a nice little contrast. So I was looking to the ground that whole backpacking trip that was in the Queets rainforest with my buddies, Ted and TJ. And that I didn't see that the entire trip, like a composition that worked, even though I was looking at the ground, like trying to find nice green plants and just something interesting. And on the hike out, I kind of tend to look down at my feet when I'm hiking too. I don't really look up. And luckily I was at this time because it was right next to the trail on the way out. It was like still 5 miles in from where the trailhead was, but just randomly along the trail, I'm like, that flower is perfectly surrounded by those ferns. And then they just kept hiking and they thought I got eaten by a bear or something. And I just stayed behind for like an hour working this scene. And God, that was just a really nice find. I don't know. It's, you get lucky, but if you keep your eyes open. So it does help to have ideas. This goes back to our earlier thing. I definitely was not the originator of that idea. You take little ideas from like, okay, maybe I should be on the lookout for shiny rippled mud or something when I'm in this canyon. But then the specific shot is still going to be yours. You know, you may be taking an idea from someone else or borrowing it like a lot of great art does. And then you just make it your own. You execute it in your own way. And I find that still to be really satisfying as opposed to a specific composition where you're just going and lining up the exact same shot and just getting a different weather, essentially, than the last person that was there. I like taking ideas, but not specific compositions.
Yeah, no, that's a stunning shot. So many of your images are phenomenal. It makes me just want to get out there and hike and look for the stuff all the time. It's just really a pleasure to have you on the podcast and to know that you're going to be with us next year doing these events. I'm really excited.
Yeah, me too.
And this is an audio podcast, but you guys got to go check out Alex's images. Tell people where they can go to see more of your work.
My website, alexnoriega.com. That's N-O-R-I-E-G-A. And on Instagram, Noriega Photography. And on Facebook, you can find my personal profile or my business page.
And search for Alex Noriega and it'll all come up. Yeah, for sure. Fantastic. Any other closing words, last thoughts before we let you go? Thanks for taking all this time out of your day.
Oh, no problem. I'm excited to come to both the conferences next year. I'm really honored that you chose me, like especially the Yosemite one. Some of those names, I mean, these are legendary guys, and to be in the same list as them is incredible. So
yeah, I kind of feel the same way. Like, I can't believe all these people agreed to do this. And now I'm like, man, I really better not screw this thing up, huh? So
yeah, that's how I feel.
No, not at all. So really excited about that one and to have you in Acadia as well. So yeah,
it'll be fun.
Yeah. All right. Thank you so much for doing this. And we will talk with you soon. All right.
All right. Thanks.
All right. Thanks, Alex. F8, The Photographer's Perspective is hosted by me, Chris Smith, and produced by Out of Chicago. A special thanks to all photographers that share their inside knowledge to make this possible. We release a new episode each week, so be sure to subscribe to the show wherever podcasts are found. To learn more about Out of Chicago and upcoming events, go to outofchicago.com. Subscribe to our mailing list to stay connected and be the first to know of our next new location where you can shoot side-by-side with the pros.